Well, this hour we're going to continue chatting with L.A. Marzulli about these elongated skulls. Amazing. And take your phone calls with him as well this hour on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with you. We'll take your calls this hour for L.A. Marzulli. L.A., so you can't tell what kind of nose or mouth they might have had?
Well, it's hard to say. It's speculative. Is it a flat nose? Is it an aquiline nose? A Roman nose? We don't know. As I was saying, Marcia Moore, who's a forensic artist who just did a wonderful job bringing these very enigmatic skulls to life, and she contributes in the book that we have, and they're just incredible portrayals of what these entities may have looked like. And they do look human. They're not like really elongated, you know, bulbous noses or something. But it's on some level, it's speculation, because we really don't know. Now, there was a mummy that I got to look at last time I was down in Peru in a private museum, and which had been destroyed by an earthquake. So we walked in. The ceiling is being propped up by tree stumps type of thing. It was really strange. And in the corner, in this other room, was a glass display case just kind of pushed back in there. And in it was a mummy still in a mummy bundle. But we got to look at this thing, and it looked fairly normal, except the head was greatly elongated. Did it have a longer neck? In my opinion, it did. But again, there's no way to tell unless you can get the thing out of there and really test it. And unfortunately, we were not able to do that.
L.A., how much bigger do you think these elongated skulls are from a typical human skull?
Again, based on my limited testing of these, I would say some of them may have 25 to 30% larger cranial capacity than a normal human skull.
In terms of, you know, inches size, let's say a human skull is 9 inches long, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it's somewhat round, but let's just say it's 9 inches long. How much would this be, like 12 or 13?
Yeah, it's something like that. And what's interesting is there's, on the website, I think I've posted on the Coast to Coast website specifically, there's a lot of different pictures, and we do an A-B between the Oregon skull and a normal human skull. And you can see the difference. You can just look at them and see the difference. This is like, it's striking. And the Oregon skull, which, again, private collection, which came from an area in Peru called La Oroya, which is a mining town now, was greatly elongated and swept back. I mean, completely different than a normal human skull. It just, you look at this thing and you go, oh my gosh. And again, the foramen magnum was pushed all the way back to the occipital plate, to the rear plate.
Let's take some calls here for you. Let's go to Walter in Pennsylvania. Hey, Walt, go ahead.
Hi, George. As usual, it's great to be on with you once
you
again.
You too,
sir.
Walt. Thank you.
Well, George, if you recall a couple of months ago, you had a Dr. Don Simborg on, and
mm-hmm.
that evening I had made the statement that since there are four great species of hairy apes, the chimpanzees, the gorillas, the orangutans, and the gibbons, I said that it didn't make sense to me that 7+ billion human beings, the veritable naked ape, could all be of the same species. So, George, I'd sort of postulated that you know, whites, blacks, and Asians were three different species. Now, Dr. Simborg said that wasn't possible because species can interbreed, but then he sort of contradicted himself when he agreed with me that it's been proven that Neanderthals crossed with Cro-Magnon man.
That's right. That's right. L.A., you want to react to that?
Well, I will. It's very interesting that let's say, and this is all conjecture, let's say the Paracas were so different, or whatever you want to call these elongated skulls found in Paracas, Peru. So we'll just, for the sake of the conversation, we'll call them the Paracas, okay?
Right.
So the Paracas people, and this is so interesting to me, they're there for a period of time, and then they just kind of vanish, George. They just disappear. They vanish. We found a killing site, and Senior Juan Navarro took us there. And this was in a place near a place called Camacho, which is probably 30-35 minutes from Paracas. We got there, very desolate, very strange place. We walked up this hill. On top of the hill, it was like a plateau. It was a killing field. It was partially excavated. The Huacaros, the grave robbers, had gone in. And we found, and I counted, I think it was like 60 skulls that were there. And there's no funerary objects. It was a mass grave, no funerary objects. These people were lined up somehow or one at a time. They were hit with blunt force trauma to the left side of the skull, which means someone has a stone or some kind of a war club in their right hand, and they're basically killing these people with a blow to the side of the head, dumping them into a shallow grave, and they're buried. And it was a very, very troubling area.
Was it like a massacre?
It was a killing field. It was a massacre, absolutely. Absolutely. And what's tragic, I went back to the site the last time I was there. We found the site. They put a new road in from Lima to Paracas, all right? Because Paracas is this beautiful bay, and the big guys are coming in there making hotels, and it's becoming a tourist attraction. So this new road is about, I'm going to guess, less than a quarter of a mile away from this site now. And already the squatters have come in and staked out the property. They've staked out the property. And last time I was there, there were surveyor stakes, basically staking out the property, which means that in a period of time, we'll lose this site. I had a forensic anthropologist lined up, ready to go and look at this site. At the last minute, he canceled.
Oh, geez.
All that to get back on track here with the point. Were the Paracas killed? Were they able to interbreed? Were the numbers dwindling over the years? So when, let's say, the Inca came in or another warring tribe came in, they weren't able to defend themselves. We really don't have the answer. They just, like the Anasazi, they just seem to vanish. Like the Hopewell or the Yadena in the Americas right here, they just seem to vanish. They just disappear in history. And no one really knows. A lot of conjecture, a lot of speculation, but no one really knows. No one has any idea of what happened. There was a biologist who wrote something, and he stated that that because of the dwindling numbers, perhaps they weren't viable. In other words, maybe they weren't able to interbreed. On the other hand, let's say they were able to interbreed, but the mortality rate among infants was very, very high. So the population dwindled. We just don't have, and this is what being on a trail, this is what research is about. We don't have all the answers.
Were there any skeleton bodies found near the skulls?
Oh, yeah.
How tall do you think these individuals were?
These were not giants. These were 5'6", 5'8".
Human size.
Yeah, human size.
Human size. How about arms, legs?
I looked for six fingers. Everything was the same.
Everything's the same. Now, and so if you were looking at them from the neck down, would they look normal?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much.
If you were looking at them with their head, would they look very weird to us? If we saw one of these walking down the street, would we do a double take?
I think you would do a double take. Marcia Moore believes, as I do, that because of the skeleton, because of the elongated neck, and she believes, as I do, that these entities had a very long neck, that it affected the entire body. They were sort of S-shaped, and their walk would have been extremely different than a normal human being. Again, that's conjecture. I'm willing to admit that, but it's based on the research and the data that we have now. So they could have been not only strange to look at from the front because of the skull, but just the way they walk, their mannerisms may have been very odd.
Ted in Olympia, Washington is now with us. Go ahead, Ted.
Hi, great show, LA and George.
Thank you, Ted.
I was actually Paracas, Peru, 3 weeks ago, and I saw the skulls. I'm also a psychic, and I have a radio show called Out of This World in Seattle.
Ah, yes, and you do. And you do a good job with that, too, I hear.
Well, thank you, my friend. Thank you so much. You've inspired me, George. I really appreciate your wonderful work.
Thank you.
Well, I spoke to the souls, and they said they were a hybrid between reptilians and humans, and their ancestors actually landed on the Nazca lines about 3,000 years ago. At the top of the skulls, L.A. and George, there's no sutures, and they said they were hatched out of eggs like reptilians. So I wanted to share that with you. I'd be happy to share messages from them, but it was very interesting talking to them.
That's intriguing, L.A.
Well, it certainly is. Let me address the lack of sagittal suture. And this is a very interesting point, because there is a disease called craniosynostosis, which usually happens in elderly people. And a certain percentage of the people will get this. And what happens is the suture the suture, which goes from the frontal plate, the top of the forehead, to the rear plate, closes. And usually what you get is what's called a sagittal ridge will happen. Well, in the Paracas people, the ones that we've seen especially, some of these people are young, based on the dentition, 26, under 30, and yet there's a lack of a sagittal suture. So we pointed that out, and immediately we were, you know, the skeptics, and I get it. It's good to have skeptics because they hold our feet to the fire and they keep us researching and they keep us looking for answers. And the skeptics will say, well, you know, the craniosynostosis. And we're going, yeah, but what percentage of the population has craniosynostosis? Why is it that in Paracas we see skull after skull after skull without the sagittal suture? Something else is going on here. And going back to Rick Woodward's work, which was just incredible, the idea of the foramen magnum being pushed all the way back to the occipital plate, the fact that the occipital condyles are completely different. And here's something really interesting. In many of the skulls, there's something called the foramen ovales. These are the holes which actually blood vessels, nerve endings come up from the spinal column into the face, which allows us to grimace, to smile, to laugh, to cry. All these nerve endings and muscles create or enable us to create the myriad of expressions that a human being can do. Guess what? In many, not all, but in many of the Paracas skulls, there is a complete absence of foramen ovales. What the heck is with that? So we think that it's genetic. We think that we're looking at, again, a conjecture, but we think it's a subspecies, like Homo sapiens sapien Paracas. We think it's a subspecies, like Denisovan would be a perfect example of that. Scientists from one tooth and a little bit of bone, created a whole new subspecies, Denisovan. That's all they have. So we've got multiple skulls here. More testing needs to be done. A lot more testing needs to be done. And again, if you're a bona fide geneticist, we are looking to get a geneticist on the team. LA@LAMarzulli.net. That's my email, LA@LAMarzulli.net.
What if these were ETs that were simply dumped here on the planet and the craft took off?
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting idea, and that's certainly a possibility.
A whole colony of them.
Well, there's a skull that I wrote about. Brian Forrester showed it to us originally. It's called Waki. And apparently a British film crew came in and filmed the curator of the museum and took DNA samples. I was actually there in 2017 and looked at it again. And they took a lot of ribs. They took a large, large sample. And from I actually saw the documentary, and what they stated was the mitochondrial DNA, and we confirmed this. We got mitochondrial DNA from it. And that came back indigenous to the population. In other words, basically B1, exactly what you would see in Amerindian. I mean, that's what you would see. That's what it was. But they got nuclear DNA because they took half the rib cage, I mean, on one side, literally. And they got nuclear DNA, and what it came back was unknown primate. So when you look at Waiki, it is absolutely alien-looking. It is bizarre-looking. The head is as big as the torso, for crying out loud. This thing is one of the strangest-looking skulls I've ever seen. It's definitely bizarre-looking, and the fact that it came back unknown primate, and as things go, I've been trying to get my hands on the actual data from that, and the communication breakdown, so far I have not been able to get it.
What has, in your opinion, with this incredible discovery, been the most shocking of everything that you've looked at?
I think the fact that, and we've already talked about it, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I think it's riveting that the foramen magnum is in a completely different place. The foramen condyles are much more robust and different looking. The foramen magnum shape is smaller and is a different shape than a normal human skull. The fact that the foramen ovales are absent, and this is the work of Dr. Malcolm Warren, there are other oddities within that skull. There are areas that are not conducive or not indicative to a normal human skull. And once we got into that really changed the equation from us. And that was one of the reasons why we decided to do the press conference, because we had all this data and we said, you know, we need to get the information out. People need to look at this. That's why we've created the DVD, which is almost 3 hours long. That's the press conference. It's all eight of us presenting all this data, including all the DNA, all the morphological differences, and then all eight of us contributed to this book. So you get both of them, and there's also a bonus DVD. We're just trying to get the word out. And you know what? It's like people say, well, all this information should be free. Well, nothing is free. It cost us well over, believe it or not, over $100,000 to get to this point, closer to $150,000 to get to this point. It's expensive. DNA testing is extremely expensive. And we had several benefactors, one in particular, who donated and helped us fund all this. But, you know, you bring a team down to Peru, that costs thousands of dollars to do, and you can't.
Oh, it sure does.
You can't jump on a plane and say, "Hey, we want to do some DNA testing. Let us ride for free." What do you think? Doesn't work that way.
LA, how similar do these elongated skulls look like the late Lloyd Pye's Starchild project?
Well, the Starchild skull, Chase Klotsky did extensive DNA testing on this after she got the skull.
She did. Yeah.
And she showed that it's basically Amerindian. It was. It was nothing extraterrestrial about it. Senior Juan had a skull very similar to that in his collection, which Brian Forrester showed us, and Senior Juan showed us. We actually trekked out to the place where he found it 20 years earlier, looking for the rest of the skeleton, but it was 20 years had gone by, and other Wakaros were there. It was impossible to pick, you know, the bones out of it. But the Starchild skull seems to be just a normal, probably birth defect for the most part. But see, that's not what we're looking at. And that's why the Starchild, a lot of hype there, a lot of stuff came down the pike. And that's why I'm trying to be extremely cautious with this and not hype it and just say, you know, here's where the haplogroup mm-hmm. are. Here are the morphological differences. More testing, underline, more testing needs to be done. But we're excited because the data speaks for itself that, in our opinion, we are looking at perhaps a subspecies.
And how old do you think they are?
Well, the Paracas show up, 3,300 years ago, and they end right around 2,000 years ago, roughly, the end of the
So
Paracas.
They go back sometime.
Yeah, well, 3,500 years
ago. And what do you think the estimated population might have been?
Don't know, but probably in the thousands.
Okay. And then what happened to them? Why are they all gone?
And this is the mystery. This is getting back to the Anasazi, getting back to the Hopo, getting back to the Adena. Who built Cahokia? Why did they abandon Teotihuacan? I'm actually working on a book on all this because I just find it absolutely amazing. When European settlers, I'm kind of jumping around here, when European settlers came into the Ohio Valley, right, specifically Newark, Ohio now, and they saw the Great Circle Mound, they asked Native Americans, First Nation people, who built this? And the Native Americans said, it was here when we got here. The site had been abandoned. And we're looking at tons and tons and tons and tons of earth and a moat and technology and building techniques, which are just mind-boggling. Same thing with Teotihuacan in Mexico, which is a completely different site, built of stone. You've got the plaza levels. You've got the pyramid of the sun, pyramid of the moon, all these mathematical and just techniques and engineering, and it's just mind-boggling.
The mysteries are phenomenal. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with L.A. Marzulli in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, John Holland joins us as we talk about communicating with the other side. Looking forward to that. Lots going on in the coast-to-coast world. Of course, we've got our own YouTube channel now. You can watch it by going to YouTube. Just type in their search engine, Coast to Coast AM Official. Or if you're on our website, right at the top, there'll be a YouTube icon. Just click that, and it'll take you straight to YouTube. And watch the channel. Have some fun. Also, the Coast Zone newsletter. Did you know it is free and it is delivered right to your computer 6 days a week? You can sign up for that by going to the carousel banner at coasttocoastam.com and sign up for the Coast Zone newsletter. And we are back with your phone calls with L.A. Marzulli as we talk about the incredible case of these elongated skulls. What an incredible discovery. L.A., what will it take, you know, to find this nuclear DNA in order to really get some results here?
Well, we know that they were able to do it with the Waukee skull. They took a lot of the ribs, and I mean they took a large, three to four ribs, about half of that. So, you know, the ribs wrap around, and they basically took some kind of a saw or whatever, and they got a lot of material. And that's what it's going to take. That's why if this gentleman that emailed me a while ago, he's got a skull from Bolivia, very elongated. It's got teeth. I would take the whole thing and ship it right up to the paleo DNA lab and go, guys, do whatever you got to do. Get the nuclear DNA.
If you were going through TSA with one of these skulls, would they stop you?
Oh, yeah, you can't do that. Samples is one thing. I mean, if it was between museums, let's say I was acting as a courier or a carrier between the Inca Museum and museum in Los Angeles, I would have the paperwork, and there'd be no problem in doing that. I mean, everything is, if you've got the proper paperwork, and we had the proper paperwork from the Minister of Culture, my name was on it, my passport was on it, it was all official, stamped, the whole nine yards. So if my bags had been searched, and because we had a whole bag of samples.
Would they have arrested you?
No, absolutely not, because we had the proper paperwork to get through. It probably would have taken a little bit of time. They would have looked at the samples. But these are samples for DNA testing. Here's the letter, Minister of Culture, blah, blah, blah. Here's the sample list. You can look at the sample numbers. It's all legit. There would have been no problem, in my opinion.
All right, let's go to the phone. Stu in Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Stu.
Yes, good evening, Carlos.
Hi there.
Question one about the mounds in Ohio. Recently, I was talking to an archaeologist who was working with someone over in England, and the topic of the Ark of the Covenant came up, and I had brought up Wyatt, Ron Wyatt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he didn't seem to have too much credence in that, and he had brought up King Arthur. And how King Arthur, there were two of them, and one of them was over here in this part of the geographic area, Ohio area, and actually, from what I understood, built or had something to do with building those mounds. The reason why I say this is because they were excavated and a piece of writing was found on some type of animal skin. Somehow or other, it connected to England and the people that had migrated up from the Middle East into England. Our history books through times have been rewritten and deliberately rewritten so that a lot of this history is not true. And it was the first time that I had actually heard this, but I looked it up on the internet and seemed to have some type of credence to it. That was one thing that I wanted to say, but then I also wanted to say I was digging with an archaeologist up in Deerfield, Mass, and the topic of Lucy and the Leakeys had come up, and I had read articles on them where they deliberately created all kinds of fraud with this evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering in my end statement if theology does not explain some of this with Nephilim, fallen angels, and yes, we have different species milling about on this planet, but does theology explain some of this?
Mm-hmm. First of all, hats off to you, sir. You asked some great questions, and you've done some research, obviously. It is my gut opinion that what we're looking at are the remnants of a Nephilim. Now, that's conjecture on my part. I can't prove that yet. But what I find interesting is the timeline coincides with the conquest of Canaan, that Josephus, the first century historian, states that the Nephilim had countenances so different than normal human beings, and that's what the Paraca skulls look like. But we also know that there were giants in the land, and we see those giants. Look, I was just down in Catalina Island today, all right?
You've been there before doing your
giant
stuff.
Today we were with Jim Watson, Mysterious Catalina, great book, by the way. We went into the interior where basically the public is not allowed to go. It's all quadrant off. But we went into the interior and we spent the day looking at some interesting artifacts. But on the way back, we stopped off at the new museum, and the picture that I discovered of Ralph Gooden, who was an archaeologist about 100 years ago, employed by the Hay Museum, and the Hay was later gobbled up by the Smithsonian. The iconic picture, which I discovered in the archives, I spent 10 hours alone in the archives with John Borgina, the former curator. So I actually wasn't alone. I stand corrected. And I'm rummaging through, looking through all these journals and paperwork and newspaper clippings and photographs. And I found four photographs. I found elongated skulls. I found six fingers. I found Ralph Gooden standing in a recently excavated grave. And in front of him was a 9-foot skeleton with its knees bent. We had that verified by three separate researchers. So getting back to what you're saying, in Ohio, that whoever built those mounds, you look at the technology, think of the dirt, and how did they compact the dirt? How did they move the dirt? How did they level, let's say in the Great Circle Mound in Newark, Ohio, how did they level that? And without, there's no transits. No,
how'd they build the pyramid? Same kind of question.
It's the same question. It's the same question.
Were these creatures at all winged? Is there any evidence that would prove that?
Interestingly enough, there is something. There's in the Paracas textiles, and this gets really mysterious. In the Paracas textiles, which are absolutely astounding, the colors are vibrant, the stitching is amazing, and sometimes they're reversible. So what you see on one side, you turn over the fabric, and it's reversible. It's just incredible, and the textiles are just amazing. Well, there are these entities. They call them the Flying Men of Paracas. And people can say, oh, isn't this lovely, and try to make it look warm and fuzzy. Well, first of all, there's serpents coming out of the mouths, and they're holding, in many cases, severed human skulls. In one case, they're actually licking the skull. So this is not a warm, fuzzy picture, in my opinion. And I think it goes back like the last caller just stated. I think we're looking at fallen angels. And, you know, when I say that immediately some people will recoil. But if I say nefarious interdimensional entity, you're right there with me.
Yeah.
So let's call them nefarious interdimensional entities, which are manifesting in our space-time continuum, that are interbreeding with us, creating hybrid races known as the Nephilim.
Tom has a text or tweet for you, L.A. What do you have for us, Tom?
L.A., we have a text in from Jerry in El Paso, Texas. He says, please ask L.A. what more tests or actions can be done to get more conclusive answers.
Well, we know
we need to nuke DNA. That's for sure.
We got it. We got to get more DNA. We would love to go down to Peru and conduct a proper archaeological dig at Chongos, if that's possible. If it's not possible, then somewhere else. There are many different sites. There are sites here in the Americas, in North America. There's one site I could take you to right now, George. Literally, right now, we could hop on a plane, go there. It's in the United States. And I could show you where at least a 9-footer is buried. And at his feet are two sacrificed females. They're girls. We know it's there. We know it's there. But we can't touch it.
Frustrating, isn't it?
Frustrating.
Do you think any of these creatures are hidden away at the Smithsonian like so many other things might be?
We had a line on that. We had a guy that contacted a member of our team, Chief Joseph Riverwind. And he said that his father was, and again, there's no way to vet this, which is why I've never really gone with it, but I'll state it here, and people can do with the information what they want to do, because it corroborates what we've heard about the Smithsonian. This guy worked on a barge on the East Coast, very close to where the Smith is, and this guy's father worked on this barge, and they would load up this barge with all sorts of artifacts and bones and everything else, and the barge would go out into the Atlantic Ocean and dump it. Well, after a couple of trips, the guy's father started, you know, pocketing some of the artifacts, as it were. And he's got over 600 artifacts. He contacted Chief Joseph Riverwind. I'm still waiting to actually fly in and look at the artifacts and just see what we got here. But that hasn't been made. This is what happens. People will contact us, and then they back off. It's really, and that in itself is frustrating.
It sure is. Let's go to Kay in Seattle, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hey, Kay.
Hi. Much respect, Mr. Marzulli and Mr. Norrie. I am so excited. My question is directed in regards to the diaspora of the South in Africa versus the diaspora in the North. That is biblically related, of course, when it comes to Joshua coming into the valley and taking out the Amorites and so on. And I very much want to know, I can't remember what haplogroup you had placed upon the elongated skull results, but I must implicate with my own experience in regards to my physical issues, that there has to be a, not just with the diaspora, but also a genetic dissension of that particular elongated skull. skull haplogroup that is maybe not of that haplogroup, but is, a dissension of that haplogroup, and how it relates to current-day diseases such as Chiari malformation and acromegaly. And I have personally met a gentleman from Philippines whose last name, quite interestingly, is Nafini. And he is a very tall man, and he has the acromegaly. And also, too, the wonderful work that you're doing in Catalina Island. I have a friend, Brent Baum, who lives there and was telling me of some of these wonderful findings. So how is the dissension of that particular haplogroup manifest itself in our disease group today, so to speak? Because I personally feel like it has, and I'm experiencing it myself.
Hmm. It's a very complex question that you ask, and it's frankly, it's one that I really have never, there's no answer that I'm aware of. I know that Dr. Michael Alday, our medical doctor, believed that it was not giantism, acromegaly like you talked about. It was not that the skulls, specifically the nine-footer that we saw in Catalina, that in his opinion, this was not giantism, the pituitary gland going berserk or whatever. What's interesting is, and this is where it goes back to the biblical narrative, there seems to be, there are different names, the Raphaim, the Nephilim, the Anakim, the Emim, the Zanzumim, and these names seem to denote different genetic characteristics. For instance, the Anakim translates long necks. Now, why is that there, long necks? And what Marcia Moore, a forensic artist who's part of the team, based on the placement of the foramen magnum, And Dr. Malcolm Warren also, and Dr. Michael Alday, same thing. Look at the skull, these Paracas skulls, and because of the placement of the foramen magnum so far back, we all agree that perhaps these entities had a much longer neck than a normal human being. Does it prove that these are the Anakim? No, it doesn't. But it's a very interesting piece of information, and that's why more study needs to be done.
Let's go to Carl in Pennsylvania. Squeeze you in real fast, Carl. Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering if they ever went and checked out the elemental composition of the elongated skull plates, and perhaps if they analyzed them, maybe they were less susceptible to Earth's gravity, or perhaps maybe the composition of the plates were more of a super sensitive antenna.
All right, interesting question. They were skull like humans, weren't they?
Absolutely.
The material.
It's bone material. I mean, we're not looking at something that's non-human per se. There's enough humanity in there, but what we're saying is it could be a subspecies for sure.
As we wrap up, LA, what's next for you?
Well, we're actually working on Fatima 2, and that'll be out probably in May. And what we discovered there, George, it sounds like hype. It's groundbreaking once again. I mean, it really is. The information, we've got photographs, which have never been released in America, and we'll talk about that in the future. But it's amazing stuff.
And, of course, you and Richard Shaw have the Best of the Watchers out, series, of course, that is fantastic. With 10 segments, it's well over 2 hours long. And, gosh, some great topics. Where do you find them all?
Well, you know, the Best of Watchers is one of my favorites is The Shroud of Turin. The other one is The Black Eyed Kids. And, of course,
David Weatherly.
And we took out the implant with the late Dr. Roger Lear. It's all cutting-edge material. Best of Watchers, LAMarzulli.net. LAMarzulli.net, you can also get the DNA evidence. It's the book. The 3-hour press conference, and there's a bonus DVD. Just go to lamarzulli.net if you're interested and support what we do. We thank you for it in advance.
Super, LA. Thank you for being on the program again. You are a wonderful guest. When we come back in just a moment, John Holland joins us as we're going to talk about communicating with the other side. As a matter of fact, his new book is out called Bridging Two Realms. Learn to communicate with your loved ones on the other side.